Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Through the Valley, My Captivity in Vietnam, by William Reeder, Jr. Narrated by Corey M. Snow. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Psalm 23, verse 4. Prologue. I played army as a kid and loved it. It was shortly after World War II when we played in the vacant lots and fields in the rapidly expanding San Fernando Valley outside Los Angeles. We used stuff from our veteran fathers or gear from the war surplus stores that had popped up after the war. My dad had been in the Navy, so I used a clunky army helmet my grandmother picked up for a dollar at the new surplus store on Victory Boulevard. We played with gusto. Sometimes we'd get wounded. Other times we'd die dramatically, only to come back to life again when we got bored being dead. One day we were playing with a group of older boys, 5- and 6-year-olds against 8- to 10-year-olds. One of my friends, wearing his dad's leather flying helmet, climbed a tree. He waved me up and we scooted out onto a low branch. He made airplane noises, held both hands up as if gripping a machine gun, and went, "Rat-a-tat, rat-a-tat-a-tat." As the bigger boys got closer, I joined in, "Rat-a-tat-tat, tat-a-tat-a-rat-a-tat." We shouted, "You guys are dead! We're in an airplane, and we shot you all!" A couple of the older boys came under us, snatched our legs, and pulled us to the ground with a thud. "We shot you down," they said. "Now you're our prisoners." They dragged us off to a deep depression near the middle of the field. In the bottom were several large cardboard boxes. The older boys said, "This is your prison. Into your cells." I crawled into a big cardboard box. They shut me in. I panicked. Closed in the dark, I felt like I couldn't breathe. I shouted, "Let me out of here!" Nothing. "Please let me out of here! Let me out! Please get me out!" I shouted, then cried, "Let me out of here! I don't like this! It's scary! Let me go!" I began sobbing and screaming. I heard my mom coming from the direction of our house. She yelled at the boys. How could they do such a thing? She tore the box open and pulled me out, holding me close as I cried and cried. I played war lots of times after that. No kids ever again tried to take me captive. But the terror of those moments in that closed-in darkness never left me. Chapter 1. Secret Commandos. My flying gear was stacked on the ground beside me on the flight line at Camp Holloway, an army airfield outside of Pleiku, in the central highlands of South Vietnam. I was waiting for an instructor pilot to give me my in-country check ride, flight evaluation, in the AH-1G Cobra attack helicopter. I'd gotten to my new unit some days earlier and was anxious to get into the fight, afraid I'd missed whatever was left of the war. At the end of 1971, we thought the Vietnam War was about over. We'd won. We'd beaten the Viet Cong and were passing everything over to the South Vietnamese Army so we could leave. President Nixon called it Vietnamization. With my check ride, I would be cleared to fly operational missions as a Pink Panther, a member of the 361st Aerial Weapons Company. We provided gunship support for highly classified special operations missions, like the insertion and extraction of elite special forces teams, sometimes far behind enemy lines. The cover name was MACV-SOG, Military Assistance Command Studies and Observation Group. SOG teams did deep reconnaissance, raids, prisoner snatches, and downed pilot rescues. I had already completed a tour of duty in Vietnam, flying armed fixed-wing OV-1 Mohawks on secret missions deep into enemy territory, along the North Vietnamese coast, all over Laos, and into parts of Cambodia. I was back in Vietnam for a second tour, a senior captain at the ripe old age of 25. I was full of myself, ready for anything the war had to throw my way. I had lots of combat exposure, but wanted to experience a whole new perspective as a Cobra pilot. I stood there, shifting my weight and crossing and uncrossing my arms. Where the hell's my IP? Let's get this show on the road. My instructor pilot was out on a mission with most of the unit. Time passed slowly. My impatience turned to concern. Wonder what's up? A young lieutenant ran from the operations shack. He saw me standing there.
Hey, new guy, want to get a medal?
Even though he'd been around for a while and I was brand new to the unit, he left it at new guy instead of the more common FNG. Fucking new guy. I figured that was respect.
Sure, what's up? Pick up your shit and follow me. You'll be flying my front seat.
But I wanted to explain that I hadn't yet had my required check ride, but the guy was gone. I chased after him, climbed into the front seat, and strapped in. Before I had my seatbelt and shoulder harness fastened, he had the engine started. The rotor blades were turning. As I tried to run through the aircraft checklist, the helicopter was dragging sideways out of its protective parking revetment. My first lesson in tactical operations in Vietnam, a fully armed and fueled Cobra was sometimes too heavy to hover on a hot day in the Central Highlands. The pilot had to use what power was available to drag the helicopter from the revetment and slide down the ramp to the runway. We skidded down the airstrip until we reached translational lift, the speed at which the rotors begin to function most efficiently, at about 20 knots of airspeed. We were off the ground, climbing to altitude. As we left the traffic pattern and headed north, the pilot, Mike Sherman, made a couple of radio calls. Then he came up on the intercom.
All set up there?
Yeah.
Smoke 'em if you got 'em. This is going to be a hell of a mission.
Okay.
I lit a cigarette with my Zippo, a gift from my brother. In the small mirror mounted on the side of my canopy, I saw Mike seated behind me. His helmet was painted black. His nickname, Hunter, was lettered on the front. He was one of the most experienced pilots in the unit.
A recon team is trapped. Tries at getting them out have been fucked. We're gonna join in and get this thing done.
Roger.
I shifted in my seat to get my chicken plate, a curved armored shield that covered my front from waist to neck, more comfortable. It sat heavily on my lap, held in place by the shoulder straps. The bottom edge dug into the top of my thighs. Most experienced gunship pilots put the plate on the floor and held it in place under their knees until they got close to their battle area. Some never used them. I endured mine for my entire first combat mission.
"We going over the border?" I asked.
"Yeah, we are.
Laos. The team is out of NKP. Nakhon Phantom, Thailand. A couple of guys are still alive. Maybe. The guy calling is not speaking English very well. Could be everyone's dead and the NVA got the radio.
Could be a trap.
Roger. Just let me know what to do. Keep your eyes open. Go hot when I tell you. Look for enemy fire. Shoot when you see it. Shoot any bad guys you see. We'll get more info when we get closer."
Roger.
We flew north through a mountain pass. A broad green valley opened before us, dotted with tribal villages, each with a high-roofed communal house in its center. A river flowed north to south. After several miles, we flew over a city and big airfield.
"That's Kontum, capital of Kontum Province, the next province north of Pleiku."
"Roger."
We flew up Highway 14 another 20 miles to a town sitting at the intersection of two big roads. We banked left and headed west toward the tri-border area, 25 miles distant where the borders of South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia came together. A large military compound lay under our wing after we turned. It sat on rising terrain, overlooking the town below. Mike announced,
"Tan Khan, home of the Arvin 22nd Infantry Division. Arvin, that's Army of the Republic of Vietnam. Got about a dozen American advisors down there, too. What's the town?
Tancon, same name.
A few miles further, off the south side of the highway, was Dak Tho. Two Cobras and two UH-1 Huey helicopters were parked to one side of the airstrip. Mike landed and hovered to a refueling point beside the runway. I held the controls. He got out and refueled the Cobra, the engine and blades still running. A big, badly shot up CH-53 helicopter was sitting off the western end of the runway. Several crew members scurried around it. I gawked. Mike finished fueling and climbed back in. I asked, "What happened to him?"
"Jolly Green, Air Force helicopter. The first attempt to get the team. Looks like he got the shit shot out of him."
"Roger that."
I had a mix of emotions.
Helicopter warfare was going to be a much closer fight than what I'd known. A rush of nausea and lightheadedness was countered by a sense of exhilaration. I was getting back into the fight in a Cobra attack helicopter.
"Get a hold of yourself.
Focus," I told myself. "Concentrate on the tasks at hand." Mike hovered over and parked the Cobra by the other helicopters. He shut the Cobra down, and we got out and joined the other crews in a short briefing. The Hueys were from the 57th Aviation Company, callsign Gladiator, also out of Camp Holloway. The Cobras were from our own Pink Panthers. Captain Dennis Trigg, the Cobra flight lead and overall mission commander, gave the briefing.
"Radio freaks, we'll be up 123.50 Victor. Understand the team is on 44.25 Fox Mike, but we'll also try emergency push. Monitor that. Covey is up 233.00. Fly at altitude en route. Drop low level on arrival. Lots of AAA out there. Be careful."
AAA was anti-aircraft artillery. He had my attention. We cranked the aircraft and took off as a flight of five headed into Laos. As we approached the border, Mike pointed out the old Special Forces camp of Ben Het. A few hundred Vietnamese Rangers occupied it with a couple of American advisors. Two Cobras were shut down on the airstrip. Mike flew over, low and slow. I looked. They'd been shot full of holes. Good-sized chunks of airframe and rotors were missing from one. How had it been able to fly at all, let alone get back across the border? Lucky crew.
"That's Smitty's bird. All the aircraft took hits. These two are out. You saw the Jolly Green."
Mike paused, as if to let that register, and then continued,
"Third time's a charm. We've got to make this one work."
We sure as shit do. I was wondering why I'd ever believed becoming an Army aviator was such a great idea. Why in hell had I pushed so hard to get back in the fight on my second tour of duty? As we crossed the border, the chatter on the radios died down. Each transmission was all business. No more bullshit. This was big time, serious stuff. Our lives were on the line. The Cobras dove to the jungle canopy. Yellow smoke rose from the trees partway up a hillside, marking the location of the survivors. The three gunships set up an oval racetrack right on the tops of the trees, covering each other, placing the bulk of our fire all around the billowing yellow smoke. After the run-in, we broke in a tight left turn to come back around the racetrack again for another attack. Tense calls snapped over the radios. Covey, the Air Force forward air controller, was overhead directing a flight of A-1 Sky Raiders, propeller attack planes. They dropped 250-pound bombs, napalm, and lethal cluster bombs on both sides of our pattern and all along the upper slopes of the hillside where the most intense fire was. Mike maneuvered our Cobra through a canyon walled with exploding bombs. Bullets came at us from all directions. With the nose turret, I aimed the minigun and grenade launcher at the source of the tracers. A few NVA soldiers were visible through breaks in the trees. Mike was unleashing pairs of rockets from the Cobra's stubby wings. We were taking hits. The sound of bullets cutting through the thin metal skin of our aircraft was like popcorn hitting the lid of a pan. I didn't have time to think or pray. I had to do what I'd been trained to do: identify targets and fire. The racetrack was established. The A-1s bombed everything around it. One of the Hueys entered the pattern, flew toward the yellow smoke, and then rocked back steeply into a rapid deceleration unlike anything I'd ever seen before. He came to a stop, hovering over the treetops while his crew threw ropes out both sides. Enemy fire erupted all around it. I worked the Cobra's weapons to cover the Huey and the other gunships. For a moment, I felt as if I were seeing it all in slow motion, a well-choreographed ballet. The performers moved with graceful precision, each perfectly according to his part. A close explosion wrenched me back to reality. We shot as close to the Huey as we dared. After an eternity of taking enemy hits, the helicopter finally pulled up, with one guy hanging from the end of a rope. The other rope flailed in the rotor wash as the crew hauled it back in. The Huey turned and climbed for altitude, flying back out through the racetrack, while the Cobras continued to suppress the enemy fire. Then we all turned and followed the Huey, climbing as the A-1s dropped their remaining bombs on the jungle. The guy dangled from the end of the rope all the way back across the border, and the Huey sat down briefly at Ben Hat. They got the survivor off the rope into the helicopter and took him to the 67th Evac Hospital at Plaikou. One survivor, one indigenous soldier out of a special operations team was saved. The others were dead, their bodies claimed by the enemy. We flew into FOB 2, Forward Operating Base 2, the SOG compound outside Khantoum, for the mission debrief. A post-flight walk-around showed a number of bullet holes in our helicopter. I looked at Mike, shook my head, and said, "I thought the war was supposed to be over." "It is pretty well over inside South Vietnam," Mike said, "but not across the border. They're all over the place out there, and up to no good." Mike finished the inspection, noting the results in the aircraft's logbook before we went into the operations hut. After dissecting the mission with the air crews and special ops staff, we cranked up the three Cobras and flew back to Camp Holloway in tight formation. During the flight, I thought about how I came to be back in Vietnam. At the concluding ceremony of Cobra School, with our families watching, the director had said, "After you receive your graduation certificates and pick up your flight records, stop by admin and get your amended orders. Most of you who thought you were going to Vietnam have had your orders changed." Out of our class of 24, only 5 of us went to Vietnam. President Nixon's policy of pacification, Vietnamization, and withdrawal was underway. It seemed to be working well. More than 400,000 U.S. personnel had already gone home. Only American advisors, support personnel, and a number of Army aviation outfits remained. They, too, were ending operations and heading home. I spent a 30-day leave with my family driving across the country visiting relatives. We stopped at every national park, monument, and historic site along the way, the routine we had established in our frequent moves. Separation was part of the job. Everyone kept up a brave facade, but I knew the sadness it created. I'd have to deal with the demands of combat. My wife, Amy, had to run the household as a single parent while worrying about me. Our marriage had been troubled for some time, which added to the tension. My 4-year-old son, Spencer, tried hard to be brave and help his mom and his sister. Only baby Vicky escaped the emotional pain, but even she sensed the stress around her. From Utah, where I left the family, I flew to the San Francisco airport, then rode a bus to Travis Air Force Base, where I would catch a military contract flight to Vietnam. I strode through the doors of the flight terminal wearing a shiny nylon Army flight jacket, pilot's wings on one breast, a large Cobra patch on the other. The Mohawk patch just below identified my unusual combination of aircraft qualifications. The 1st Aviation Brigade patch on my right shoulder, with its golden eagle and silver sword, showed that I was a veteran of a previous tour of duty in Vietnam. I checked in, dropped off my duffel bag, turned and scanned the room. Forrest Snyder, one of my classmates from Cobra School, stood up as I walked toward him. Forrest was a smart, well-spoken, polite lieutenant, not the image of a flamboyant attack helicopter pilot. "Hey, Forrest. I'm on the flight leaving in 3 hours. How about you?" Yeah, same flight. It's kind of ominous heading out on Pearl Harbor Day.
I hadn't thought about that.
Don't worry. Everything's good.
We boarded the plane and sat with Bill Davies, another Army aviator who had managed to smuggle a fifth of Jack Daniels on board. We asked the stewardess for three Cokes. When she saw the whiskey, she was quick to bring refills. We drank our fill and passed the bottle around the plane. After it was empty, the flight attendant stuffed it upside down into the magazine rack at the front of the cabin. There was a spontaneous cheer. In Honolulu, we spent the layover drinking Mai Tais. Back on the plane, I passed out and slept most of the rest of the trip, waking with a hell of a headache when we landed at Tan Son Nhut Air Base in South Vietnam's capital city, Saigon. I survived the bureaucratic processing through the Long Bin Replacement Center nearby, where the assignment officer had said, "War's over, son. Not much going on anymore. We need your experience at headquarters, not in the field. Units are standing down. Going home." "I want to get to a tactical unit that's still in the fight," I said. "I've trained to fly Cobras in combat. That's what I want to do. My dad and uncles fought in World War II. I had a cousin in Korea. This may not be much of a war. Looks like it's about over, but it's the only war we've got." He stood up and said, "Hang on a minute, let me see." When he returned, he said, "Lucky day for you. There's an attack helicopter company doing special operations work in the Central Highlands." "Great," I said, grinning. "You depart at 0700 tomorrow morning with another new Cobra pilot, Lieutenant Forrest Snyder. I'm sending you both to the 361st, the Pink Panthers." "Forrest's coming with me? Outstanding!" But I remember thinking, hope I haven't gotten him into something I shouldn't have. We made it to Camp Holloway in a series of unnerving flights, the first in the belly of a C-130 propeller-driven cargo plane with no seats. We sat strapped to the metal floor with a long piece of 2-inch nylon webbing across our laps. We transferred to the back of a CH-47 Chinook, a tandem-rotor medium-lift helicopter. At Holloway, we were run up the back ramp like so many cattle. Chapter 2 Pink Panthers. The Army's airstrip at Camp Holloway, 2,500 feet above sea level, had been carved out of the fields and forests outside Pleiku in the Central Highlands. The camp was dirty and, depending on rain, either dusty or muddy on any given day. Luckily, it was a bit cooler than most of Vietnam because of its elevation. Tin-roofed huts and hangars clustered along both sides of a 5,000-foot runway constructed of perforated steel planking, or PSP as it was called. One side of the runway was a regular little town for air crews and support personnel. The rest was taken up with maintenance hangars, operations, shacks, a refueling area, and scores of revetments to protect the parked helicopters. Off a ways was a rearming point and ammo dump. While I was there, the ammo dump was blown up occasionally by a rocket or mortar attack. It was always quickly resupplied. The attacks rarely affected combat operations. On the rust-colored expanse of the base, nothing grew thanks to constant applications of defoliant. A perimeter of earthen berms, pillbox-like fighting positions constructed from sandbags and recycled PSP, and rows of concertina wire surrounded the camp. Guard towers rose above the stretched coils of razor wire. We were an isolated, protected enclave, having little contact with the world outside except for flight missions day and night. Our crude, tin-roofed sleeping hooches were crammed with stereo tape players, big speakers, small refrigerators, and, most importantly, air conditioners. We had headquarters, mess hall, supply rooms, a medical clinic, a barber shop, and even a small gift shop. U.S. car manufacturers' representatives clustered around a central store, the PX, ready to help us buy a car at wholesale prices while in Vietnam to be delivered at home at the end of our tour. We had an officer's club, too, a necessary place for young men to unwind after flying in the face of death each day. In addition to the main club, the 361 Small Officer's Club, the Stick-It-In, featured a bar, a few tables, and a hole in one wall so you could dive into a sandbagged bunker during rocket or mortar attacks. We loved it.
Camaraderie grew from our flights on SOG's secret operations. We cemented those bonds at the Stickit Inn, drinking way too much, telling tall tales, and acting crazy. Several days after my first combat mission, I was sitting in the Stickit Inn, drinking and telling war stories with Forrest and a couple of other new pilots. We had flown a few more missions, none as harrowing as the first, which I was recounting. One of them said, "That must have been a hell of a day. Scary?" "Not really," I boasted, but instantly corrected myself. "Yeah, scary as shit, actually," I admitted. "Scared the fuck out of me. But I did okay. I did it." We do what we've been trained to do. No time to think, just have to do. You know how, and you do it. I slammed my glass back on the bar. I survived some hellacious missions on my first tour, too. I was shot up lots and shot down once. Somebody asked, "What happened?" "Took a 37mm anti-aircraft hit in the right wing, attacking a fuel depot hidden under the trees. Classified mission in Laos over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. As I pulled up from a rocket run, wham, the whole right side of the aircraft seemed to explode. We tumbled out of control, the right wing shattered and was on fire. Worked it hard, got back some ability to fly, got the fire out, but we were descending fast, could not hold altitude. I gave the command to eject, the observer went out, I pulled my seat handle right after. I had a very short parachute ride. Got only partial chute deployment before hitting the ground with a thud. We were crashing through the treetops by the time I punched out. Wow. Yeah. Then I was nearly captured. I ran through the jungle for 45 minutes while my wingmen put down suppressive fire. That earned me the nickname Lightfoot. Got plucked out of the jungle by an Air Force helicopter from the 20th Special Operations Squadron out of Thailand, call sign Pony Express. Spent some time in the hospital there. Eventually, I returned to the unit, back to flight duties. We'd lost 15 airplanes at that point, out of 18. 30 crew members shot down. Not many of them ever recovered. I was one of the few. Lousy odds. I was scared then, I'll tell you. If you don't get scared in combat, you're a liar or nuts, I continued. Only after a tense mission is over does the real fright come. When there's time to sit and think, you watch it all play in your mind and wonder how the hell you lived through something like that. I looked at them and grinned. Enough to drive a man to drink. Forrest said, "I thought the war was over. Thought we'd miss the combat and would be bored to tears. The press claims that Nixon's Vietnamization is working, the Viet Cong guerrillas are beaten, the U.S. is going home, all is quiet in Vietnam, the war's won." All true, just not across the border, in Laos and Cambodia. "We've seen that the regular North Vietnamese army is thick over there," I said. Someone asked, "What do we do if the NVA come across? There aren't any American ground units left in the highlands." I had no answer. I thought, if the shit hits the fan, I'll be fine. Other guys get killed, not me. I'm the lucky one. Across the room, pilots began chanting, "Panther piss! Panther piss! Panther piss!" Two guys came up beside me, grabbed my arms, and led me to a bar stool in the center of the room. They filled a bizarre-looking mug with booze from most every bottle in the place, topped it off with a large plop of unknown gunk from a jug pulled from the refrigerator. The mug was passed around so anyone could add whatever they wanted to the mix, except lighter fluid, brass polish, or any known or suspected poison. The thing was handed to me. The guys by my side grabbed me and stuck their wet tongues deep into my ears. A commanding voice ordered, "Drink the piss of the panther!" I stared at the awful-looking brew. Pubic hairs floated on top of putrescent goo, all eyes fixed on me. I guzzled. I almost puked, but I chugged it down as they chanted. When I was done, they cheered. Guys patted me on the back. Now I was in the brotherhood of the Pink Panthers. Forrest and the other new guys followed, each downing a mug of panther piss. One bolted from the room, spewing vomit as he ran. I kept mine down, but I felt like shit. The room began to spin. Faces got more surreal with each whirl.
Great guys, these guys, I thought. I ricocheted out of the club back to my hooch, fell into bed, and passed out till morning. This would not be...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?